Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as Rolling Stone, ClassicBands.com, ClassicRock.about.com, New York Times, The Week Magazine, The News and Observer, The Independent, BGORecords.com, and Entertainment Weekly. I was introduced and we both started grooving. She said, I dig you, baby, but I got to keep moving. This opening number, Mary Jane, is brought to us by Tom Petty. We'll be hearing more about and from Tom Petty later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions today are brought to us by www.triviaplane.com. First question, who was described as a woman who pulled herself up by her bra straps? And the second question, which 1960s number one hit began with the French national anthem? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by VGORecords.com, Today in Rock History. And today is June 26 and June 27. So what were the number one hits on June 26 in previous years? Well, back in 1965, you may remember it was The Byrds with Mr. Tambourine Man. And back in 1983, it was the Flashdance soundtrack that was number one on June 26. If you were born on June 26, you share a birthday with Elvis Presley's manager, Colonel Tom Parker. He was born on that day back in 1910. And Billy Davis Jr. of the Fifth Dimension, born on that day, June 26, 1940. Larry Taylor of Canned Heat, born in 1942 on June 26. You also share a birthday with John Ilsley from Dire Straits. He was born on June 26, 1949. Mick Jones, also from The Clash, 1955. And finally, Colin Greenwood of Radiohead was born on June 26, 1968. Vernon Presley, Elvis's father, died on June 26, back in 1979. Miscellany and rock history on June 26 includes 1964's Rolling Stones release, It's All Over Now, in the UK, their first number one single. And back in 1975, on June 26th, it was Sonny and Cher's divorce is finalized. She married Gary Allman 4 days later. And that was, of course, Greg Allman. What were the number one hits back on June 27th? Well, that included 1960's Connie Francis, Everybody's Somebody's Sweetheart. And back in 1964, on June 27th, it was Peter and Gordon, World Without Love. And back in 1998... The Corrs with Talk on Corners was the number one hit on June 27. If you were born on June 27th, you share a birthday with Bruce Johnston, The Beach Boys, 1944, June 27. Miscellany in rock history, back in 1885, Chichester Bell and Charles Tainter apply for patent on their invention, the gramophone. The patent was granted on 9 May, 1886. Back in 1964, the Drifters enter the Hot 100 with Under the Boardwalk. 1964, same year, Jan and Dean hit the U.S. chart with Little Old Lady from Pasadena. Back in 1969, 5 years later on this day, June 27, Denver Pop Festival begins at Mile High Stadium featuring Jimi Hendrix, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Joe Cocker, and Creedence Clearwater Revival. Back in 1971, on June 27th, it was the Fillmore East closing. And finally, back in 1989, on June 27th, The Who performed the rock opera Tommy in its entirety for the very first time in 17 years at New York's Radio City Music Hall. The show raised money for a children's charity as well as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This next article is from GuitarPlayer.com, published on June 2007 by Jude Gold, entitled Van Halen's Secret Ingredient. When Hurricane Van Halen struck the shores of guitar culture in 1978, the all-engulfing blues-based flurries of notes were so fast that few people realized Eddie Van Halen's primary influence was Mr. Slowhand himself, Eric Clapton. One reason EVH could play Clapton-esque blues riffs at such blinding speed is because he often included, and sometimes pulled off to, his secret ingredient, open strings. Dig how the open strings in the BM7 example make the swirling quintuplets easy to play, and how shifting the moves down a string changes the general harmony to G7. Notice that only the first and last notes of each quintuplet are picked. In local rock news, we see this article by David Minconi entitled, From Russia, Her Love. This article was published on June the 13th, 2010. Few Americans know Russia as well as singer-songwriter Alina Simone, which is ironic. The Chapel Hill expatriate who lives in Brooklyn was born in Russia in 1975, immigrated to America as an infant, and grew up pretending her Russian roots didn't exist. But after deciding that she wanted to reconnect with those roots about a decade ago, she got a job in international development and made plans to travel to her native country. Simone's first Russian excursion took her to deepest Siberia immediately after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. She has been back many times since, looking up relatives and using music as a way into Russian culture. She researched and recorded an album of songs by the late Siberian punk legend Yanka Dalgyovaya, 2008's Everyone is Crying Out to Me, Beware, amassing enough anecdotes for a memoir about her adventures in the world of underground Russian rock. You Must Go and Win will be published next year by FSG Books. Meantime, she shares some of her tips and experiences. Question. In traveling through Russia, how big a drawback is not speaking the language? Well, it's not like Amsterdam where everyone speaks English and it's the predominant second language. I would get on something like couchsurfing.com and try to find some way to connect before you leave. Create a project, find someone there who shares that fascination and speaks English, and they can be your guide and translator. It could be something as straightforward as learning Russian, or as quixotic as documenting Soviet-era bus stops. For me, it was learning everything I could about Yanka, which took me all over Siberia. A project gives each day a purpose, provides you with a good excuse to talk to people, and helps you avoid tourist malaise. Question, the Cold War has been over for a while, but are there still reminders? There are plenty of reminders of the Soviet era. You'll see no trace of Stalin or former KGB head Felix Dzerzhinsky, but Lenin statues are ubiquitous. There are still lots of tanks up on pedestals. The hammer and sickle remain enshrined in a lot of architecture. Many Soviet holidays are still celebrated, though sometimes only in a winking kind of way. You see war memorials in every city, lots of monuments to Soviet military power. Question, does Siberia have what Westerners would think of as a conventional tourist attraction? If you're just looking for exotic, wacky kitsch, there are tourist attractions that are neat-looking and a fine way to spend the day. The world's biggest Lenin head is Ulan-Ude, capital of the Buryat Republic. It is, as advertised, very large. There's also Lake Baikal, the biggest and deepest freshwater lake in the world, which is vast and beautiful. But it's a 5-hour plane ride from Moscow and another 45 minutes on a bus, and what you find is a really big lake that's too cold to swim in. My job sent me to the city of Tyumen this past November, and hands down my best day off ever was a just-open hot spring resort about an hour away. Finding yourself in the midst of a Siberian snowstorm while lounging in hot mineral water is both surreal and divine. If Novosibirsk is the Seattle of Siberian, then Tyumen, which completely lights up at night, would have to be the Las Vegas, albeit in a more linear 80s Atari game type of way. Question, what about less conventional things to do? Well, you could take a trip on a typical Russian riverboat, not a touristy cruise for foreigners, but a teplohod, going by boat from Novosibirsk to Tomsk, which is well known for its preserved wooden architecture, makes for a very pleasant half-day trip. Novosibirsk has some interesting examples of constructivist architecture, if you're a building buff. It also has a great local coffee culture. Independent espresso slingers were cropping up here long before a coffee house, the Starbucks of Russia, made itself ubiquitous. Question, have you run across any strange local customs? Well, there's Ivan Kupala, an old pagan holiday on the 6th of July, which comes from an old fertility rite. All I know is that you see young men chasing women and throwing buckets of water on them all day long. I was in Tomsk, and I saw a lot of wet women and dry men running around with buckets. Final question, are there any warnings you would give? Well, keep an eye on your paperwork. If you go on a tourist visa, you're required to stay in hotels that register foreigners, and sometimes they'll forget to stamp your passport. When I was here for 5 months in 2005, the wrong date got stamped to my passport, and I literally couldn't leave. And you don't want to lose your passport because you can't go anywhere without one. Can't get on a train or a plane or register at a hotel. Legally, you're not supposed to walk around without documentation. Wherever you are in Russia, they are pretty serious about their paperwork. This next article was published in the News and Observer on the 23rd of May, 2010. If you've got the money, musicians are there for you. This was originally published in New York Times. Helene Aguirre traveled to Hershey, Pennsylvania, all the way from Sao Paulo, Brazil, for a front row seat to see her favorite band, and she got it. A black metal folding chair with a golden cherry red Bon Jovi logo on the cushion. Hers to take home, the price, $1,750. It was an amazing experience, even more than I dreamed, Aguirre, 25, gushed after the show on Wednesday night, as she packed up her chair and lugged it to the parking lot. Nearly a decade after the producers introduced the $480 ticket to Broadway, VIP pricing has established itself in the ledgers of rock and roll. This summer, Justin Bieber fans can pay $350 to attend a pre-show sound check. For $800, Christina Aguilera will pose for a picture. For $900, Eagles fans get dinner but no photo op. Most packages also include plenty of swag. As Bon Jovi's 3 sold-out shows this week at the new Meadowlands Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, the top package, which includes the takeaway chair, a leather bag, and a catered meal, is $1,875. Once available only for top-dollar tours by the likes of U2 or the Rolling Stones, VIP packages have trickled down to the rank and file of live music as artists try to maximize grosses and reap some of the markup value that the best seats get on resale sites like StubHub.com. And despite the soft economy, promoters have found that hardcore fans are willing to pay premium prices to get red carpet treatment for their favorite shows. It's probably the biggest negotiation in any tour deal, said Randy Phillips, the chief executive of AG Live, promoter of the Bon Jovi tour. On a hot night, you can make as much money from 10% of the house as the other 90. Artists and their managers say the VIP programs allow them to dote on their biggest fans, rewarding loyalty with special treatment. Lori Huey, a 44-year-old accountant in New Jersey, has bought 6 various VIP packages for the current Bon Jovi tour at a cost of about $8,500. Years ago, I used to have to pay a scalper that to get front row, Huey said. I would rather pay the Bon Jovi fan club or Ticketmaster and know what I'm getting because I've gotten burned by scalpers. What fans did not see backstage, however, was Bon Jovi. The most famous, the star, the less available they tend to be to fans, no matter the price. But Rick Springfield sells ample schmoozing time before and after his shows for $1,000, which includes a seat on stage. Rick's fans are incredibly loyal, which is the reason he's still able to have a career, manager Rob Koss said. He's very cognizant of that. Some consumers, however, are super premium pricing as a little more than exploitation. The artists are just gouging their fan base, said Terrell Lowe, 49, a brewery sales executive and an avid concert goer in San Francisco. The majority of people just can't afford that. So what do you know about our featured artist today? Tom Petty. Well, this bio of Tom Petty was provided by RollingStone.com, and portions of this biography appeared in the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, Simon & Schuster, 2001. Jim Mackney contributed to this article, and it was all updated through 2009. Since his arrival in the 1970s, Tom Petty has proved to be one of rock and roll's most consistent and great hit-making machines, mixing up old AM radio hits, chiming birds' guitars, Rolling Stone rhythms, and his trademark vocals, which neatly combine Bob Dylan and Roger McGinn. First penning tales of outcasts and long-suffering lovers, he broadened his thematic range to encompass musings on his Southern heritage and to propagate a very American kind of individualism. Petty's knack for pop architecture has earned him respect from fellow heavy hitters. Not everyone gets to form an informal side project with Bob Dylan, George Harrison, and Roy Orbison. Petty, the son of a Florida insurance salesman, quit high school at 17 to join one of the state's top bands, Mudcrunch, with future heartbreakers Mike Campbell and Benmont Tench. In the early 1970s, they sent newest member to Los Angeles to seek out a record contract. Petty delivered, connecting with Denny Cordell's Shelter Records, which was co-owned by Leon Russell. The group disbanded soon after moving to L.A., and while Cordell offered to record Petty's solo, nothing happened until 1975, when Petty heard a demo that Campbell and Tench were working on with Ron Blair and Stan Lynch. They all connected, and the quintet not only became the Heartbreakers, it inherited Petty's Shelter contract and released a self-titled debut in 1976. At the heart of its sound were Petty's 12-string Rickenbacker guitar and his nasal sneer of a voice. With a solid stomp driving them, the music seemed simultaneously classic and fresh. At first, the record sold poorly. Then the Heartbreakers toured England, opening for Niles Lofgren. Within weeks, they were headlining, and the album was on the British charts. ABC then re-released Breakdown in the U.S., and the single cracked the top 40, nearly a year after the album's initial release. Another song, The Very American Girl, was recorded by Byrds boss Roger McGinn. The band's second album boasted the singles Listen to Her Heart and I Need to Know. The Heartbreakers' career was igniting, but Petty became mired in a legal battle after trying to renegotiate his contract. By mid-1979, he'd filed for bankruptcy. After 9 months of litigation, Petty signed to Backstreet Records, a top MCA affiliate. His triumphant return, the now classic Damn the Torpedoes, hit number 2, selling over 2.5 million copies, and established the singer as a star. Both of the album's singles, Don't Do Me Like That and Refugee, did well. Petty always had a populist view of rock, and in 1981, he again got into another record company hassle by challenging MCA's intention to issue his new disc, Hard Promises, with a $9.98 list price, one of the first albums to charge a dollar above the standard price point. After he threatened to withhold the LP or entitle it to $8.98 and organized fan protest letters, the company relented. Led by The Waiting, album came out at $8.98 and went on to platinum sales status. He forever became a friend of the record-buying public. The article skips down. In 1986, right before Petty and the Heartbreakers embarked upon a world tour with Bob Dylan, Petty's house burned down. Arson was suspected. His wife and two daughters escaped, but most of his belongings were destroyed. 1987's Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, hit number 20 and was certified gold, a relatively disappointing showing in view of the group's 1980s success. Petty had fallen in with several of his rock star pals in the interim, turning friendship into business with the founding of the Traveling Wilburys. The band featured Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne, and their self-titled 1988 disc earned itself a hit with Handle With Care. When he began his first solo album with the Heartbreakers, he took Lynne with him as producer. The result was the masterful Full Moon Fever. It's Free Falling gave him a hit that revitalized fans' appreciations of his skills. Article skips down and ends with this. In 2008, Petty and the Heartbreakers performed at the Super Bowl halftime show and announced another U.S. tour. Petty also reformed Mudcrutch, playing bass as he originally did for a brief tour, and a self-titled debut album that proved their rangy country rock was in fine form. During his 35 years of action, Petty had only released one live album. The singer rectified that in 2009 with the Live Anthology, a 48-track blast of rock and roll that featured hits Breakdown, Free Falling, Deep Cuts, Spike, and speckling of cool covers, Dave Clark Five's Any Way You Want It, an instrumental spin on the theme from Goldfinger. So let's listen to some snippets in from Tom Petty. We'll start out with Learning to Fly.
Well, it started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone, and the sun went down as I crossed the hill, and the town lit up, the world got still. I'm learning to fly, brain got wings, coming down.
And now we'll hear a snippet from Free Falling.
She's a good girl, loves her mom, loves Jesus in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too. And it's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard, and I'm a bad boy, 'cause I don't even miss her. I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart. Now I'm free.
And now we'll listen to a snippet from Refugee. Close out today's program with the Traveling Wilburys, of which Tom Petty was an instrumental part, with their hit The Devil's Been Busy. But first, these articles. This first article is published in the newsandobserver.com on September 27, 2009, entitled Scholars Study All Things Boss. Hold still, Bruce, this won't hurt a bit. Scholars from around the world are dissecting the Springsteen legend this weekend in New Jersey. Glory Days, a Bruce Springsteen symposium, continues through today at Monmouth University. The no-holds-barred intellectual romp, coinciding with Springsteen's 60th birthday, once again this was 2009, was organized by Virginia Tech and Penn State Altoona. And yes, the scholars do get the comedic irony of studying a man who learned more from a 3-minute record than he ever learned from school. The festivities include several pilgrimages to the landmark Stone Pony Nightclub down the road in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Educators spent Friday night singing, hollering, and chanting a curse phrase at the impish urging of rock pioneer Gary U.S. Bonds, whose performance brought the house down. Springsteen resurrected Bonds' career in the 80s by writing his comeback hit, This Little Girl. Professors, many of them veterans of dozens of concerts, one boasted 150-plus, vied to get out their first-person tales from the concert pit. Fans of Run of the Steel Mill, Springsteen's former band, also entered the symposium fray. Springsteen has saved my life many times, said textbook publisher Patty Pappas of Toronto, who detoured to the symposium en route to next week's Meadowlands concerts. If you're sad, happy, angry, if you want to scream, rant, and rave, there's always a song that can express it. Come the light of day, though, it's back to the books. Make that the PowerPoint presentations. Fun? Said Presenter Francesco Cassino of Rome, clearly startled by the question during his reverie of harmonic sequences. His expression grew otherworldly. It's my life, he said, Saturday, expressing the common theme of fans everywhere. His music can call us to a higher purpose, said Dr. James Kelly of Carlow University in Pittsburgh, calling Springsteen a vehicle for discussions on social causes, war, race, gender, and class. Finally, this album review, published in Entertainment Weekly on the 18th of June, 2010, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Mojo, Rock. Tuneful and gently flowing, Mojo is endowed with the qualities diehards expect from Tom, Watch Me Rock Out Without Breaking a Sweat, Petty. What it lacks is instant classics. Didn't he used to be good for a few per album? Even so, a handful of these new songs comes within spitting distance of past glories, as Petty sings on the last track, That's Good Enough for Me, given a B by Tom Sinclair, and he recommends downloading these songs, Hip Shaker, Let Yourself Go, and the optimistic Something Good Comin'. So how'd you do on the trivia questions? First question was, who was described as a woman who pulled herself up by her bra straps? And that was, of course, Madonna. And which 1960s number one began with the French national anthem? And that, of course, was All You Need Is Love.
While you're strolling down the fairway, showing no remorse, growing from the poisons they've sprayed on your golf course. While you're busy sinking birdies and keeping your scorecard, the devil's been busy in your backyard.
The Traveling Wilburys. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until... Next time.